It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Spring planting season is underway in Wisconsin. Producers and growers across the state are beginning the process of planning or planting their crops for the year.
During this busy season for farmers, there's a new wave of uncertainty sweeping over croplands, with cuts to the Federal Agriculture Department and reciprocal tariffs on U.S. agricultural products.
To learn more about the impact on farmers in Wisconsin, we're joined by Jerry Clark, Regional Crops and Soils Educator for the Division of Extension at UW-Madison. Jerry, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for the invite.
Yes, and Kat Becker is here, owner and operator of Cattail Organics in Athens, producing organic vegetables, seedlings, maple syrup, and herbs in central Wisconsin. Kat, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited for the conversation.
Kat, starting with you, you have your hands in the soil. Where are you at with the spring planting season? What's going in the ground?
Yeah, so we're actually located in north central Wisconsin in the northwest corner of Marathon County. And so we are actually not in the fields yet. I would say Marathon County, depending on soil type, is just starting the production season. There's been very little tillage and planting so far where we are. But we are a vegetable farm with some covered production. So we have hoop houses and caterpillar tunnels. So we have been planting for over a month. And so we're continuing that planting as well as planting in our greenhouse. We're hoping to be in the field this late spring by the end of next week.
We've had some rain and wet conditions. Is that okay for now?
You know, as a vegetable farmer, we try to predict the weather as best we can. But, you know, often we do have wet, cold springs. Last year was an exception to that. And so, you know, we often just plan to be in the field that first week in May and we cross our fingers. It'll be a couple of weeks earlier. So we're in good condition. For folks doing crops, it always sets them back a little bit more. Grain crops, you know, the earlier you can get those in, the better. But the soil is just not warm enough up here yet.
Okay. Thank you for that. Turning to Jerry now and looking a bit at the political situation around agriculture. We saw in February the Trump administration canceling programs, giving schools and food banks money to buy food from local farms. What impact are you hearing from the farmers you're in touch with?
Yeah, I think the uncertainty of some of the federal funding, especially for some of the farm programs and programs like the food bank and those school lunch programs, those kind of things. I think that uncertainty is what's, I think, farmers are really concerned about at this point. Going into this growing season, a lot of the funding or a lot of their inputs were already paid for, you know, kind of a prepaid type of thing last fall, depending on how their income was going into the winter. And so now that we see, you know, tariffs starting to come in and some of the political landscape changing, that's where now, as we move from this point moving forward, as farmers get ready for planting, that's where we're going to start to see the impact of the new tariffs that have come on in just the recent months.
And Kat, the Department of Government Efficiency that continues to cancel funding for multiple farm programs, food programs, what effects is it having on your farm?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I'll talk to the impacts that it has on our farm, but I will at first echo Jerry in saying that the thing that we're struggling with, and we see our neighbor farmers, you know, we're in a big dairy producing county, what they're struggling with is that uncertainty. You know, as farmers, we know the weather will be uncertain. We know there are things we can and cannot control, but being in a landscape where we aren't sure what's happening on a week-to-week basis, it is hard to make responsible and consistent economic choices. And I think that that's happening throughout agriculture. It's difficult to be a good business person when you don't have clear information. In terms of those programs, you know, our farm was a recipient of both the LFS, Local Food for Schools, and the LFPA, Local Purchasing Assistance Agreement, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm horrible at that acronym.
Local Food Purchase Assistance Program.
There you go. Perfect. Uh-huh. That one is the one that's farm to food bank, people say. For us, you know, that is going to impact our income and planning. Right now, we're trying to pivot and find other markets, but also since it's really unclear if LFPA, for instance, will make it into the state budget, if any federal programs will get reinstated, we're just trying to make the best decisions we can on a week-to-week basis. I mean, I think the question of, you know, inputs certainly have impacted our farm. And I think the other big impact you're seeing from our farm and similar ones is that we just aren't moving forward with investments that we plan to make in our farm because we want to be conservative with our budget to make sure our employees are paid and have the hours that we plan to have for them and to make sure our business can be resilient even in that time. And so we are investing less money into our local economy at this time of year where we would be spending and doing building projects that we planned.
So it sounds like you're taking it day by day.
Yeah, I would say that that's the case of many farmers. And I would say with grains, I mean, that, you know, those folks are really having to make decisions in ways that are really complicated in terms of what crops to plant because different crops are impacted by tariffs differently. For us, yeah, we are taking it day by day and week by week as we try to build out other markets, but also because we are dedicated to providing food for schools and food banks, we want to make sure that we still have that in our plan. So, you know, at this point, we have a lot of stuff in the greenhouse, extras of certain crops planted, and then we're basically throwing out seedlings versus planting seedlings on a weekly basis based on what we expect in the market. And I think that's common for a lot of farmers, mm-hmm. that kind of week by week adjustments as we best can.
Kat Becker with us owns Cattail Organics in Athens, a farm in the north central part of the state. Jerry Clark is here with the UW Division of Extension in Chippewa County as we talk about planting season, the impact of tariffs, cuts to the USDA. Jerry, talk a little here about the trickle-down effect. How do cuts to the USDA ultimately affect consumers?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kate, because what we see is usually you'll see when we have these tariffs or any cuts to USDA, those are income dollars that farmers would normally have. Or as we move the market forward, we would see where from a grain marketing perspective or even the dairy industry here in Wisconsin, those impact directly from the standpoint of having the market is going to adjust itself based on what it sees as supply demand. Mm. And so as we see cuts to USDA or tariffs coming in, the market reacts in that there's going to be more supply. And as we go into a planting season, this is where we see, farmers making adjustments, whether it's corn, soybeans, small grains. Are they going to, for a dairy farmer, are you going to plant more alfalfa, these kind of things? So, some of these conservation programs that have been cut, those are the things that we see overall. The net farm income can be reduced, and therefore farmers are going to have to make that adjustment on the fly. And then the market with uncertainty tends to drop a little bit. And so with consumers, because there is the tariffs and some of these cuts, we can see those prices at the retail side go up simply because there can be more supply out there, which kind of runs counterintuitive to the supply-demand curve. But we also look at it from the input side. And if it's going to cost farmers more to put these crops in, net farm income drops, and therefore across the board, there's less dollars out there to spread around. So we usually see the market at the consumer end, those prices tend to increase, whether that's for meat, poultry, cereals, anything like that. And also that infrastructure starts to be more expensive. The bottom line, the farmer doesn't gain a lot of income from that sale at the retail level. Maybe 10% on a box of cereal goes towards the farmer. The rest goes for the marketing, the infrastructure, the transportation, storage, all of these kind of things that are starting to go up in price, and therefore that gets passed on to the consumer. So the raw product part, you may see that dropping in the news or in the market. You see the market price drop, but that doesn't mean it's going to drop it at what you buy on the shelf, because all of these other pieces that USDA has had cut, or we see the tariffs affecting that price.
So
at
many
the,
forces
on the shelf.
Yeah, so
correct.
Many forces. Kat, perhaps a big picture question here. If the government continues to dismantle local foods programs, local food systems, like the local food for schools cooperative or the local food purchase assistance, how does that affect hunger? How does that affect nutritional needs?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things to just underline here. First of all, the local food for schools program is not the main way that schools get fruits and vegetables. So it was a supplemental program that allowed schools to directly get produce at far from farms and farms to be compensated directly for that produce. And so school lunch at this point is still intact as it has been. And there are other ways to ensure that those programs do continue. I would say right now at the state level, there is some introduced language to include universal school lunch. Having universal school lunch is more important for the ability of schools to purchase local food ultimately than the LFS program in the long term. And so I do think the state should be looking at that solution. And I think we will see states absorbing a lot of those costs, even though obviously many of the taxpayers are paying into the federal system and not seeing that money come back. But that, you know, it will impact schools' ability to experiment more or to get the freshest produce versus some of the more cheap USDA frozen products that are available. From the food bank standpoint, we really need to underline that right now there's a contraction in federal food aid generally. And so it's more of a catastrophic impact that the LFPA program is being discontinued. And again, I'm hopeful the state will be able to pick up some of that because federal programs generally for food aid, those related to COVID, and then also some of the Biden administration's expansion and that hunger relief are being rolled back simultaneously. And so you see a huge impact in the food aid system and, you know, local areas. While we can do fundraising and we can, as a county, try to step up, realistically, local governments are not in the financial position to absorb that type of need. And ultimately, you're talking about hungry children, hungry families, and people not being able to eat high quality food, which has repercussions for health, for school outcomes, and all of those things. And so I think in terms of food aid, that's really a very big deal and something we need to be turning our attention to.
Kat and Jerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is Kat Becker, owner and operator of Cattail Organics in Athens, Wisconsin. Jerry Clark, an agriculture educator, has been the crops and soils agent for UW-Madison Division of Extension in Chippewa County since 1998. We talked about the spring planting season and the uncertainty for growers with recent federal cuts to the USDA.
Coming up, the Doge team led by Elon Musk has or is seeking access to a lot of our personal data held by the federal government. A Wisconsin cybersecurity expert weighs in on the process and the risks.
In terms of our cybersecurity adversaries, the state actors that happen to be out there, I don't think they've ever had it so good.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Without judges, lawyers, or clerks, Wisconsin's court system would grind to a halt.
The same is true for court interpreters, who ensure that everyone involved in the proceedings can understand what's going on.
But, as Sarah Lear reports, finding the right interpreter is often challenging because of high demand for the profession.
When Remy Bashi first started as a court interpreter in Milwaukee County Circuit Court, she wore high heels to the courthouse.
Then I went to flats. Now I'm in the sneaker phase.
On a recent Friday, Bashi put those sneakers to work as she walked from hearing to hearing in the sprawling complex that houses Wisconsin's largest circuit court. As a freelance Spanish language interpreter, Bashi's services are in high demand.
I turn down almost as many jobs as I accept.
Under Wisconsin law, people with limited English proficiency have the right to a qualified interpreter in circuit and appellate courts. That applies to victims, their family members, witnesses, and people accused of crimes, says Kimberly Beyer, an attorney in Milwaukee.
In our country, the idea is that everybody in court is supposed to be equal. Just because you don't speak English as a native speaker doesn't mean you don't get to be in exactly the same situation as someone who does.
But Beyer's seen cases be delayed while a judge searches for a qualified interpreter. For some people, that can mean more time stuck in jail. Once, Beyer had a client who had to wait months for a resolution to his parental rights case.
It really was pretty painful having to tell him over and over, we don't have enough interpreters, so we're going to have to get a new date, because there's all this build-up to your court date.
Janice Palma is with the National Association of Judiciary Interpreters and Translators. Palma says many states, not just Wisconsin, are struggling with an unmet need for court interpreters. She says higher pay would help alleviate the problem.
There is a demand for certain skills and certain knowledge, but that's not being compensated at the level that is being demanded.
Most court interpreters in Wisconsin are independent contractors, and their wages vary depending on how commonly spoken their language is. Recent Wisconsin-wide data shows Spanish interpreters earn an average of $70 an hour. Hmong interpreters earn nearly $90. Being a court interpreter takes more than just being bilingual. As Palma points out, you have to process what's being said and switch it from one language to another almost simultaneously.
All of this is happening at the same time. Your brain is working overtime. And this is very difficult for some people to realize. This is a very high skill.
Bashi has spent years honing those skills. She's one of about three dozen certified Spanish interpreters in the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin judges are supposed to use certified interpreters whenever possible, but certification exams are difficult and only a few people pass each year. Bashi believes those high standards are needed to ensure quality. She says higher pay and a more established educational pipeline could increase the supply of interpreters. Back in a Milwaukee County courtroom, Bashi puts on a black headset.
So this is the transmitter, and these are the receivers. So the interpreter speaks into the microphone, and the people that are wearing the headsets are hearing the interpretation.
Bashi interprets from English to Spanish and back again as a man is sentenced in a reckless driving case. The judge hands down some jail time, and Bashi takes off her headset. Then she's back on her feet in the courtroom hallway, waiting to be called wherever interpretation is needed next. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Two court rulings on Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency came down on different sides of the debate over whether DOGE should have access to personal data held by the federal government.
A federal judge ruled that DOGE couldn't have access to personally identifiable Social Security Administration data and would have to purge all non-anonymized data that they'd accessed prior to that ruling.
And an appeals court allowed DOGE to have access to sensitive data at the Treasury Department, the Education Department, and the Office of Personnel Management.
That's a departure from long-established protocols for who can access this kind of data and when they can do it.
A Wisconsin cybersecurity professional joins us now for a look at DOGE and data and what's at stake for Americans.
Chad Johnson is an assistant professor of computing and new media technologies and principal faculty member of the undergraduate and graduate cybersecurity programs at UW-Stevens Point. He's director there of the Digital Forensics Lab. Chad, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I want to start big picture. We keep getting this drumbeat of information in lawsuits, public disclosures, things like that, about what kind of things this DOGE group is accessing. Big picture, based on what you're able to see, how much of a concern is this for you as a cybersecurity professional, the kind of access and transparency we're seeing here?
I don't have any special insight into the agenda or processes that are being utilized here in this situation. But from my perspective, as an outsider looking in and with my industry experience, I'm not seeing signs of a lot of best practices being followed.
Right. If you were consulted by a group that was going to, say, audit the computer operations of, I don't know, an IRS or a Social Security Administration or what have you, what would those best practices look like from the start?
What we would normally be seeing if we were seeing the audit being done in accordance with best practices is a little bit more transparency. There's typically no problem. And as a matter of fact, most frameworks will encourage doing things like publishing methodology and updates, milestones, and so on, just outlining the process and the progress of the audit as it goes. And I don't think we're seeing a lot of that right now. It seems like a lot of what is actually being done is not being shared with the public. What we're seeing are the purported results of the efficiency finding measures, but nothing on the actual process itself.
And we've seen, as I mentioned, lawsuits, and they've gone back and forth as they've moved up from one court to another. The Social Security Administration, we had a block on access to some data, then a requirement of anonymized only data, and then arguments over, well, is there read-only access versus can somebody actually change files? Can you sort out from us what these different kinds of access to big, important files might mean?
Well, it, again, depends on exactly what the agenda is, because there's a lot of different ways to interpret from the outside what they could be attempting to achieve with the access that they've been able to gain. I will say that read-only access is typically going to be sufficient for a number of objectives that there could possibly be. And, you know, read-only access is essentially access to the information. Doesn't allow you to change it, but it does allow you to view it. And information is power. That alone is a significant amount of potential influence, you know, that could be gained if information were viewed or copied or anything in that fashion. Certainly being able to delete or modify data, which would be additional permissions to that sort of, you know, those data repositories, that would obviously be a concern. We certainly don't want any of the important information that they're accessing to simply be deleted. I mean, it would be like achieving efficiency by removing the brakes on your car. You know, it's more fuel efficient, but you're going to have another bigger problem in that case. So I would say certainly if we were to see something like that, that would be a major concern. But personally, and as an expert in the field, I'd say read-only access in this situation is plenty of concern for me.
We're talking about cybersecurity and DOJ's efforts in the federal government. Chad Johnson is with us, assistant professor at UW-Stevens Point in Computing and New Media Technologies, also director there of the Digital Forensics Lab. Given all the data that the federal government has, all the data points that might be collected by the IRS, the Social Security Administration, the Department of Education, Small Business Administration, the list goes on and on. How bad would it be if that information were mishandled, went into the wrong hands, whether that's a corporation that wants to use them for their own purposes, a government leader that wants to misuse them, a foreign government? How big a treasure trove of information are we talking about here?
Well, this question is difficult to answer because the last thing I want to do is contribute to any any panic that there may be out there. That said, I do think that concern is warranted. So the amount of information that we're talking about here it's unprecedented. The closest breach that I can offer would be the Equifax breach from 2017. And that was essentially a record on most adult American citizens. I mean, anybody that had a record with Equifax at the time as a credit reporting bureau had at least some of their information taken. And that information was largely what we call PII, or personally identifiable information, which means that it was a lot of demographic information, name, phone number, address, you know, work history, some financial information, but mostly what would be considered directory information or non-sensitive information. That information alone is significant in terms of a data breach. I mean, what happened with Equifax was without a doubt devastating. And we do believe that that was conducted by foreign actors that specifically wanted to get information about American citizens. So I suppose if you consider things from an attacker perspective, an advanced persistent threat, some state actor out there, why would they be interested in simple PII on American citizens? I mean, they too wouldn't have destroyed or altered any of that information. They simply copied it. They had read access essentially as well. Well, the answer is that information isn't useful in, like, for example, organized crime. It could possibly facilitate identity theft. But for the most part, we're talking about nation state espionage here. They want information on American citizens because it is useful to them in their national objectives. If the systems that we're seeing if the information that DOGE is accessing, if any of that were to be leaked or lost in any fashion, I mean, it would be devastating. And honestly, these systems as they are now, at the actual agencies, they are under a lot of cybersecurity purviews. There's a number of acts and FISMA and best practices that are implemented in order to protect them. And we have no indication that DOGE is following any of those at all. So they're probably a lot softer targets now than they were before, all things considered. So I would say there's a significant danger here. I would say that that in terms of our cybersecurity adversaries, the state actors that happen to be out there, I don't think they've ever had it so good.
Chad, an interesting thing about all this federal government data is a lot of systems, apparently, as I understand it, don't talk to each other, right? The Social Security has their stuff, the IRS has their stuff, and they haven't been sharing across. I've filled out FAFSAs for my kids, Department of Education. Well, you can fill in your IRS data, but you need to give special approval to do that. The argument from DOGE is we're going to bring these systems together. It's going to help us efficiently catch fraud, right? And maybe illegal immigration, things like that. The counter argument is, hang on, that system is not a bug. It's a feature. It's a way to help protect our privacy. That's something we want to do on purpose. What do you make of those two different philosophies of should all these different government data troves be in touch with each other?
The pursuit of efficiency and cost cutting, of saving tax dollars, as admirable as that is, does that outweigh the need for security that happens to be here? There's an expression that I think we're butting up against here called the Chesterton fence. The idea is that I think a farmer buys a new plot of land, and as they're surveying it, they see that in the middle of the field there's this barbed wire fence. They look around and there's nothing around, but they know that it would be just so much more efficient if they were to take the fence down, and then that way they don't need to travel around and go through the gate or work around the fence, essentially. So they remove it, and then a couple of seasons later they find out that the fence existed for a reason, and now they have a problem with cattle getting loose on their land. It's a Chesterton fence, a defensive strategy that is implemented, but the reason for it is no longer known. It's tribal knowledge that's gone, and somebody comes along and doesn't recognize its purpose but says, hey, this is inconvenient, and so does away with it and then finds out the hard way why it was implemented to begin with. I think that's what we're dealing with here because, the separation of these systems, it's separate for a reason. Yes, it is partly to protect our privacy and to make them easier to secure. Typically, having all of your eggs in one basket is a bad defensive strategy to begin with, but it's also designed to separate things out to make things harder for attackers. They may infiltrate one system and they'll get some information, but they don't have enough information from one attack to see the entire picture. Ironically enough, it seems to me that one of the things that may be attempted here is exactly that, as in consolidating all of this information may indeed be the plan, because having all of that information in one place does allow you to do things with it that we can't currently do, which could be argued to be efficient, I suppose, in some fashion. I mean, for example, now we have data systems that work with huge data sets in order to make all kinds of inferences. They require large data sets in order to make accurate inferences and in order to make use of the data in different ways. I think that might be the plan here. So yes, efficiency, but efficiency at the cost of security. And therein lies the problem, because what we're talking about here are competing interests, directly competing interests. They are mutually exclusive, unfortunately, in this case. But one of those interests is foundational, and one of them is aspirational. We can't have efficiency unless we are secure. We don't have anything if we can't maintain security. It's the absolute most basic principle of a nation state that we are able to protect our assets. So I don't really see it as a trade-off. It's a sacrifice, if anything else. I think that there are efficiencies to be made, and I think that there are ways to do it, but I see very little evidence that we're going about it the right way.
As someone who's teaching cybersecurity professionals of the future, are you bringing the daily news into your classroom? Are you looking at possible teachable moments that we're seeing in our national news?
I certainly am. It's really hard to avoid, obviously. It's a huge issue. I see this as a real threat to the industry as it currently stands. And from my perspective anyway, it's a pretty fragile industry. I mean, think about what things were like in terms of cybersecurity just 20 years ago. It was a very different place, you know, back then, and we were a lot more vulnerable than we are now. I don't really feel like we are in a strong position in terms of our national posture in cybersecurity right now, but I feel like we're a lot better off and we're headed in a good direction. And I feel like there's been a major interruption. And for my students, for example, this semester, I'm teaching risk analysis and security assessments. And one of the things we're talking about is access control and the process of identity proofing and vetting and gaining access, maintaining entitlements and that sort of thing. And a lot of what I'm saying, it's clear that it's just not being followed right now in our current federal government, the current administration, both in terms of what DOGE is doing and in other areas. It's really underscored the lack of care, I think, the lack of due diligence in the security mechanisms that were in place.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Chad Johnson, Assistant Professor of Computing and New Media Technologies at UW Stevens Point, cybersecurity expert there. He talked to us about security and privacy issues with Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Do you have more questions maybe that conversation raised that you'd like to hear answered? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up, fancy Wisconsin cheese makes its debut at the Kentucky Derby atop the heads of fashion-forward spectators.
The most elegant day in sports. You're not going to wear a cheese head. You're going to wear a fabulous formaginator hat. So when they challenged me with it, I was like, this makes total sense.
Meet the New York milliner behind these creations. That's next on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In a little over a week, Wisconsin cheese will make its debut at the Kentucky Derby.
Not on the track, but on the hats, displayed on fashion-forward spectators. Think Sartori Merlot Bellavitano on a hat and Marika Gouda fenugreek atop somebody's head.
Christine A. Moore is a hat designer in New York City. She has been the Derby's featured milliner since 2018.
And this year, Moore partnered with Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin to unveil a collection of cheese-inspired headpieces.
The collection is called Rinds and Roses, with proceeds from the sales benefiting a diabetes center in Kentucky.
And if you're picturing a Packer cheese head, well, not that. These are elegant designs that pair great cheese flavors with high fashion, but no picking off of them. They are not edible.
Christine A. Moore has been creating hats professionally with her own brand for over 30 years. Christine, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. My family is from the Midwest, not Wisconsin, but all around. This New Yorker feels like partly Midwestern. How about that?
I love it. I love it. Yes. This is absolute crunch time for you. What is so special and inspiring about creating Derby headwear?
Well, you know, I come from the theater world, and then I studied art rendering, and then I fell in love with sculpture in art school. So really, when I create derby hats, it takes all of those elements and puts them together. And I mean, it's explosive. It's fun. It's bright. It's like happy. It's, you know, really where Easter used to be like the kickoff for spring. It really is the Kentucky Derby, you know, those 2 minutes kickoff spring. But, and I also say, and this is crazy, but true, anything can be a hat as well, except you have to do it with elegance, because my style you know, is elegant and very detail oriented. And what do you say? There's a lot of integrity to it. So that's what I always say is the main thing you want to see with a derby hat is elegance. So it's all of those together, all those things.
And theater people are such have such a can-do spirit, a can-do mentality. Like you can design anything. Is there anything that in a hat that has caused a challenge to you?
Yeah, the Wisconsin cheese. I mean, I've had a lot of projects, a lot of, you know, design asks, and I've loved every one of them. This project, the Wisconsin cheese for Maginators, Rinds and Roses, was the most difficult because where before I'm designing a concept, like they might say, okay, I want a, you know, hat with cupcakes on it, or I want, you know, a sunburst or something like that. Like that's my idea of what those, you know, what that would look like. But this was different. This project was different because I had to repeat another artist's work. So all of these six cheeses that made the cut to be featured at the Kentucky Derby and on this Formaginator, like I was taking their artwork and repeating it. And that was really very difficult because I had somebody on the other end of it. So it wasn't just my imagination of what a piece of cheese looks like. It was somebody's specific piece of cheese. So that was really difficult.
Oh, so it ended up having to be more of a collaboration.
Well, yeah, actually, at first, you know, they sent me cheeses. They sent me a lot of cheese, by the way. It was really good.
Hard work there, Christine.
Yeah, really, twist my arm. Yeah. So I had, they had sent me their preferred cuts of these cheeses, and I studied them, and then I repeated what I saw, and then once they were finished, the cheese specialist came in and said, well, you know, everything looks really great. Can you make the paste, which is the white part of the cheese, the part you eat, can you make that a little creamier? and I was like, well, this is fabric. I don't know how that's going to work out. But, you know, I used only silk and linen for the rinds and the paste because I'm known for just using natural fibers. And then, of course, the inside, but the inside is carved foam. Mm-hmm. So it was like, well, I just can't get that. I can try my best, but I don't know if I'm going to get it's quite as creamy. But it was a nice challenge to see what we needed to do to be able to do that. And what it came down to is like, if you're going to represent, just like in a painting, if you're going to represent my cheese, can I have it the way I really like my perfect piece of cheese? Right. And that was really, yeah. And so I got it because I was like, yeah, of course. Like I do that with my staff all the time. I'm like, you know, here's my rose. I want you to repeat my rose perfectly. You know,
Well, cheese is an art form in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, anywhere. Oh, my gosh. And I can't even imagine. I think they had 600 people apply. And they picked like six of them. And I just can't even imagine what the rest of them, how beautiful. Because I have, you know, I see the cheese. I eat the cheese, right? I never, the rind's nice. But now I'm like, oh, no, look at the rind.
Yeah, up close. And it's not just the cheese. I mean, I'm looking at one here that looks like an elegant cheese board plating. It's got figs and apples. And so you have to get those right, too.
Exactly. And that's kind of the wheelhouse. Like, I didn't have to ask God how he liked the pear. Because it's like, you know, it is, I could just repeat what I see. And it's kind of cartoonish, but that's what makes it fun. I designed it, sketched it with meat on it. They decided they just wanted to wear it. I was doing little rosettes. You can kind of see how that.
Yes. Yeah.
Maybe, and the peonies, especially how that would work out, that I could make like a little meat rosette. And have it look like a flower, but they decided they just wanted to have fruit and the cheese. And I think that my signature roses. So I thought that worked out really well, you know, as far as like, we didn't need the whole cheese plate on there, you know, just pick out some elements and, But it was fun. It was a lot of back and forth. They asked us in the beginning if we were willing to collaborate. And being from the theater world, of course, I'm going to do that. That's just how, you know, you're used to that.
Did you feel like you grew in any way as a milliner out of this experience?
Oh, I definitely. I think every season and every season I grow, learn a little bit more, different techniques. I mean, having to figure out the creaminess also taught me a little bit more about, you know, what silk will do, you know, what the stiffener that we use, like different things, like how much we want to use and how little, and, you know, how to make something stable. And these hats, you could do jumping jacks once they're on and you have a comb set in the back. You could totally do a cheese and stuff. Yay, cheese! And do a jumping jack on this.
And I'm wondering just about that. How do you strike that balance between high design and the practicality of wearing this hat in the world or at the Derby, but also having it represent something so detailed like a cheese?
Well, I think Derby's a long day. You know, what are the 11, 12 races? And the Derby's like 10 or 11. I mean, if you're going to be committed, I think true fashion in general, you walk in, unless there's a reason you're changing your clothes, you walk in with your look and you walk out. Like, are you ruined your story? Right? So I think that, you know, I wanted to make these hats that they would be worn for the entire day. So the comfort was a big deal. The hats that just have the fascinators that have the three cheeses on them, two or three that are specific, like the Gouda, you know, specific to the cheese. Those are definitely easy to wear.
We're talking with hat designer Christine Moore about her process of designing the Rhines and Roses collection for this year's Kentucky Derby with inspiration from Wisconsin cheeses. Christine, you talk about fascinators, and I'm wondering, can you give us more definition of what a fascinator is and how it works?
Okay, so the fascinator is like the basically the trim of a hat on a headband or on a small base, and then it perches on your head opposed to framing your face like a hat would. And then, like I said, you can have like elastic that goes behind your, you know, along the nape of your neck. Or you could have a headband that sits like, you know, a metal headband or a plastic headband. And then there's a comb. I put a comb in all of mine in the back so that you arrange the hat on your head. And then you take the comb and you shove it into your hair in the back and try to pull the lowest part of the fascinator towards your eyebrows. That's the best way to wear a fascinator. And that's usually before the mint juleps, because you never know where the hat's going to be on the way out.
Okay, so you're heading to Louisville for Derby Week soon. And
that's right.
We want to walk in your shoes. What is that day like for you at the Derby? What comes up? What is it like to be you?
Oh, let's see. First of all, I have toothpicks in my eyes to hold them open, right? I finished my hat the night before in the hotel, probably at 1 or 2 in the morning. Let's see. I have heels on. Well, I had sneakers on because I did press on the backside. So, and hopefully it's not muddy. This is for Oaks and Derby both days. And then I change my shoes and come around to the front side. And usually I'll meet and greet people out in the paddock, or I might go up to the floors. We also have a setup at the Derby Museum in the for Derby Experiences, which is just an organization that brings people to the Derby. So I might go over there. But I'm basically running back and forth in the front, like I call it the front of house, you know, obviously not the track, running back and forth through the building. And it's massive. It's massive and it's getting more massive, you know, as they're building onto it. Then my hats are set up also at the Paddocks shop. And then I have a setup there with that store. And then from 12:30 to 2:30 every Oaks and Derby, I'm there specifically to meet the attendees that are wearing my hats, and they get, you know, they can either you know, I can print them, that we get photographs for social media.
Any hat emergencies at all? Or
yes, and we had, and then there are emergencies. There are dress emergencies. There are, you know, shoe emergencies. I had to glue somebody's shoe back together last year. I've sewn people back into their dresses because the zipper popped. Straps have popped. And then, of course, you know, things like I can't get my hat to stay on my head. And usually they put the comb in wrong. So we're like, here we go. I'm not here to torture you, but I'm going to make sure this never moves again. So, and once that, usually they're like, after the initial shock of having the comb jammed in your head, then they're like, oh, thanks. This is great. I can, you know, in the end of the day, the hat hasn't moved and they were happy. You know, one of the things about the Derby is it's fantastical. So I say anything can be a hat. So that would include cheese. Why not? Or it could be, but I think the main thing is whatever you want to do at the Derby, it's the best of the best. Your best fashion goes here. You want to be elegant in whatever you do. I can't say that enough. So that's why I think, like, if you want to wear cheese on your head, if you want to have, you know, well, I don't want you to have a stuff pony on your head, but I mean, like, if you do something well, you know what I mean? Like, why not? You know, because this is the time that the Derby is like that. Okay. You know, so it's like, you know, it becomes very personal.
We have styrofoam cheese heads. I don't know if that is any inspiration.
Well, I think that was really, when I was tasked with this job, that of course is what I first thought of. I thought, this is perfect. Like, the most elegant day in sports, you're not going to wear a cheese head. You're going to wear a fabulous formaginator hat. So when they challenged me with it, I was like, this makes total sense, you know? So, yeah. So no cheese heads. Well, it'd be interesting how many people come with a cheese head, but, you know, but once they see, they're going to have to, they're going to come and upgrade. There's no doubt about it. They're going to be like, I need a formaginator. This cheese head's not cutting it anymore.
Oh, those are fighting words.
Hey, I just thought of something though. Could you imagine? I didn't think about the future in football. Can you imagine though, if we see in the crowd the formaginator at the Packers games?
You're gonna need a bigger studio for that. You're gonna need a bigger space.
Yeah, exactly. No, why not? Oh, come on. I can do it. I mean, I have a bunch of crazy artists that'd be like, yeah. But I mean, I'm just even thinking if I saw one in the crowd, I'd be like thrilled.
It all starts with one. Christine, right. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
That is Christine A. Moore. She is a hat designer in New York City and the featured milliner of the Kentucky Derby. We spoke about Rhines and Roses, a special hat collection she created for this year's Derby that put 6 Wisconsin cheeses in the spotlight. It's a first of its kind headwear line transforming award-winning Wisconsin cheeses.
Buying a car has been an adventure at some points in recent years, first with the disruptions from COVID, now with question marks over the impact of tariffs on the auto industry.
We'll talk about that tomorrow with a used car dealer. And now we want to hear from you. Are you in the market for a car, or have you bought one recently? Did you move up the timeline on buying a vehicle to get ahead of tariffs?
Or are you in the car business? Do you sell cars? Either way, we want to hear about your experience in the auto market, buying or selling, normal or unusual.
Email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. And we'd love to learn about your experience and share your story.
Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Colleen Leahy, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.